Good morning, this is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. Thanks so much for listening to the show that celebrates all things creative. And of course, we are going to tune our imaginations together and share some great stories. What has been one of... Excuse me, I'm going to start again. We got microphone issues this morning. It's always a something. So I'll start that again. What has been one of your most wondrous life experiences? One of my most awesome life experiences happened in a corporate jet. Usually this private jet was full of awkward silence. This was way back in the 90s, and we didn't have cell phones on the plane or entertainment screens on the seat backs. We might have had giant planner books with our schedules and notes, or maybe this was the time when personal digital assistants became popular and we were young corporate types and had Palm Pilots. Do you remember those? The execs had the front seats, and I was even just lucky to be on the plane, so of course I sat way in the back. And we followed the schedule of the bigwigs. We had to arrive very early for the flight because this was not our show. There was no in-food flight service. The worst part of the flight was the bathroom. You planned what you drank and prayed that you never had to go to the bathroom. I wish I would have known about adult diapers back then. Might have saved a lot of anxiety. You never wanted to be the one that couldn't wait until we landed. Way in the back of the plane, there was a seat cushion you lifted up and a curtain that you could pull around the seat for quote unquote privacy from the other passengers. Never did you want to be that one. You monitored your liquid intake on the trip from corporate headquarters Des Moines to the publishing capital of the world, New York City. And the plane was always full because everyone who was eligible to ride on the corporate jet wanted to get a seat. Then one day it happened that my boss Beth and I were the only two riding on the plane. We were so excited. When the cab driver taking us to the airport asked what time our plane left, we got to tell him when we get there. That was such a wild day. And I don't remember if this was the same trip or if we were lucky to have a second trip by ourselves on this fancy jet. The most awesome day from that job was on that plane when it was only me and my boss. It was the late 1990s, and there was a chance that we might see an outer-worldly phenomenon. Everybody was talking about the comet Hale-Bopp. This object was probably the most viewed space visitor in the history of the Earth. Many people saw this wonder. It was one of the brightest comets to reach the inner solar system, 1,000 times brighter than Halley's Comet. And then it happened to us. We were flying on the jet and got to look out the plane window and see the comet Hale-Bopp. We were stilled by the moment. We looked in awe. Awe, it's the only word that befits the rare moment. It's an awe that is joy, pause, spirit, and wonder, and all wrapped in disbelief and faith and all that's the strands of time bundled like a bungee cord between the now and the future and the past. We moved freely around the plane looking for as long as we could. We caught glimpses of the blue and white comet tails, that moved across the evening sky. The plane went one direction and the comet confidently cruised on its path through our world. My heartbeat felt like the only thing moving in the world, and I wondered what propelled the comet's exploration. How is it moving? I suppose I could have asked myself that same question about the plane moving, because I also don't completely understand how the plane stays in the air. It was real and unreal at the same time. Everybody was talking about this comet, and even more than 25 years later, I can take myself to that big, wondrous moment. It brings tears to my eyes and love and longing to my heart. I'm flooded with all the life that has passed in those years since that moment, and I wonder where the Hale-Bopp comet is today. Do you think the comet wants to take another trip around the Earth? How do you put into words what we can't understand or what happens so fast? It's a blip in the record of worldly history, and yet it is the moment that showed me how small we were on that fancy plane in this gigantic, unknown world. Today in Art Zany Radio Studio, I am so excited to welcome novelist Peter Guy to discuss A Lesser Light. This novel is set on the rocky shores of Lake Superior at the turn of the 20th century, and it's a story of Theodolf, a master lighthouse keeper, and his new wife, Willa, a well-educated young woman and a reluctant bride with her eyes to the night sky. The book explores how selfhood and determinism develops. Is the future that what we're headed or what we make of it? And I'll say that one more time. Is the future what we're handed or what we make of it? You can get more information about this book at the University of Minnesota Press, upress.umn.edu, or Peter Guy, and I forgot to write this down, but I believe it's peterguy.com. We'll double check on that. And Guy is G-E-Y-E. And he will be here in Northfield at Content Bookstore on Wednesday, the 23rd of April at 7 p.m. So please mark your calendars for that. And we'll talk more about the book, but I want to jump in and bring Peter into the show. Just one sec here. Like I said, we got some microphone things, so it's a longer reach to get over there. Welcome to the Art Zany Radio, Peter.
Hi, Paula.
It's such a delight to hear from you again. Oh, my goodness. I've been waiting for your next novel, and it's here. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's brand new. It just came out on Tuesday, so it still feels like, you know, like an infant, like I have to swaddle it and sing it to sleep and all of that.
Is it like Christmas a little bit, or is it even bigger than that?
You know, being like Christmas is a good explanation for it. And I was just thinking about this. I had a big publication party on Tuesday night, and so much preparation goes into that, so much excitement, and in the way that preparation and excitement go into Christmas. And then all of a sudden it's midnight on Christmas, and all you have to do is take the trash out, and it feels like what just happened? And it kind of has that feel to it.
Yeah.
But unlike Christmas, I guess I get to keep on talking about it and visiting stores like Content and libraries throughout the state of Minnesota. So there's plenty to look forward to.
Right, exactly. That it gets to live its own life now, off in the world, and you get to help that. And I hope I can help introduce this to people as well. I wanted to, just by way of introduction, ask you if you had any thoughts about what might be some of your most wondrous life experiences. What are some of the most amazing moments from your writing life?
Yeah, it's such a profound question. And I loved how, as you were describing that, the sense of awe you felt and the sense of wonder and the fact that you couldn't understand it. And it just made you feel, you know, small and insignificant in the universe. And
absolutely.
I had that feeling quite a lot. And I had it especially often when I was writing this book. And I think that that's partly because the older I get, the more I realize that any story I have to tell is just a part of a larger story that people are telling each other, and that it feels very much as though it were just a fleck of stardust in the universe or something, the novel, or any novel for that matter. And I actually, if that sounds like it's, you know, diminishing the role that these books have in my life, I think it's just the opposite. And I don't know, I mean, to recount the most important moments or magical moments in my life would be impossible. Of course, meeting my children for the first time as they were born, you know, childhood memories with my siblings, all those things come to mind. Losing both my mother and father, the loss of them has been enormous and powerful and poignant. But for the purposes of this conversation, I actually have a pretty great example, and it has stuck with me so many times. We were camping, my kids and my wife and I, up on the North Shore at Split Rock State Park. In fact, this was probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, something like that. Just as I was starting to think about getting to this book for real. And we had a couple of different tents because we have a big family, and the kids were being mischievous and sneaking out of their tent at night, and we had a perfect view of the lighthouse. And my daughter came running into the tent and knocked on our tent window and said, "The lighthouse light is on, the lighthouse light is on." And it was the middle of July or whatever, no reason for the light to be on. And I thought, it's not on, you're seeing something. Or whatever. And she said, no, it's on, it's on. And I said, I'm going to go to sleep. And she came back again 5 minutes later and she said, it's really on. And so I got out of the tent and went up over the little ridge, and there it was. And it was the first time I had seen Split Rock lit. And it was almost like, I don't know, like it had a magnetic pull. And even though I'd been contemplating writing this book about that time, it was, I mean, it was like a siren call or something. I don't mean to sound melodramatic about it, but it had that effect, like, okay, now it's time to get down to the business of writing this book. And I think for each of the books that I've written, there's been a moment like that where a crystallization of thought or coming together of various strains of thought that has compelled me to get to it. And it's usually from that moment, and in this case, it was actually seeing the lighthouse lit, that I was drawn to it, and then I got finally down to the work of doing it.
That's a beautiful story. Oh my goodness. Thankfully she was persistent and you didn't give up. You didn't give up on that. So
Was only the it was the first best example of how persistent she can be. These days, it's mostly persistence for getting a trip to Starbucks or something like that.
yes,
Now that she's a
exactly.
little bit older.
That happens. For our listeners, this is Paula Granquist. I'm here with Art Zany Radio, and I'm talking with Peter Guy. And I forgot to mention that this is, in fact, his sixth novel. He is the award-winning author of Safe from the Sea, The Lighthouse Road, Wintering, Northernmost, and The Ski Jumpers, which was from Minnesota Press in 2022. And he lives here in Minneapolis, but he's coming down to Content on, this is Wednesday of next week, the 23rd of April, 2025, at 7 p.m. So we're very excited about that. And I think I was most excited to see that you'd set another novel in Duluth and Lake Superior. And you are connected in some deep way to this place, and especially to that time period of, the early 1900s. What is it that you think that is the draw or the connection or the reason that that is just a central piece of your writing life?
Well, I mean, with respect to the lake, I think the answer is pretty simple. It is that is the North Shore and Lake Superior and the wilderness all around there has been since I was a child and remains still certainly one of my favorite places, but also one of the most magical places that I know. And when I say magical, I mean that it always surprises. There's as often as not something to be kind of creeped out about or just in awe of the beauty of. And I love that range of experience that you can have there. The weather is such a magnificent and essential part of life there. The people are so steady and so stoic, and I guess I vibe with that or something. And I just love it. So it's this place that, though I've never lived there, I've spent what feels like a lifetime there, partly because I visit so often, but more so because I write these books that are set there. And so even when I'm not visiting, there's a part of me, my imagination or my spirit or something that is up on that water. And I love it for that. And it nurtures me for that. As far as the time period goes, I mean, I have less of a clear answer for that, less of a clear thought about it even. I think that the easiest and most forthright answer is that I'm always most comfortable as a novelist when I'm removed from my own experience. And part of that removal is done through simple characters, what they do, who they are. Part of it is done through location, where the novels are set. So I have to remove myself up there to a place that I've never lived to imagine writing about it. And time is maybe the best example of that. That is, if a character lives 100 years ago or more than 100 years ago, if a story is set that long ago, I have a broader range of my imagination that I get access to. And so I think it's actually easier for me. Yes, there's some research to do, and yes, I have to make things plausible and realistic, and all of that takes effort. But for the storytelling part of any novel, I get much freer range because I'm wholly beholden to the characters and not any prejudices or limits to my own morality or spirituality that I might otherwise impose on the story.
That is fascinating, because that idea of going back that far is a little intimidating, but you have created a world that is so vivid and detailed. I mean, we learn about lighthouses and, of course, daily life in the 1900s, the night sky, the invention of telescopes and the kind of medicine that they had, the religions they practiced, fishing and shipping, and everything is so exquisite in this novel. And even preparing for this show, this short, very short opening about the Hale-Bopp comet, I got pulled down into a search hole rabbit hole and had to drag myself back up to finish. So I'm wondering how you create that world and how you keep track of the story and keep, like, I'm doing this because I need to know a detail for the story and not because this is so fascinating.
Well, it's oftentimes difficult to tell the difference between whether or not it's for the story or for my own curiosity or edification. Those details, that is. I mean, I think that in the department of writing novels as a practice, I have discovered over the years, and so as you just mentioned, and it's hard to believe sometimes, this is my sixth novel. And you learn something from each of those, but rarely does the lesson apply twice, except for in the department of organization and planning and doing research and knowing when to turn the page on that research. I've never written a book that required as much research as this, never even half as much. But I've learned to, in one hand, hold all the possibilities, and in the other, know when to take what I've got and run with it. So when I start researching a subject, Halley's Comet, for example, eventually, and actually not eventually, quite soon into the process of doing that research, I realized that I was never going to understand the science behind the comet, not fully. I could I could catch glimpses of it or something, but I'm never going to be an astronomer. I guess that's what I'm saying. Not even close. And so I had to relegate the deep science of it to that. None of that is going to be in here. And focus instead on the sort of poet's view of the comet and the elegance of it and the beauty of it and the mystery of it. And Willa, who's one of the main characters in the book, the main character in the book, is our scientist. But she's also been removed from her life as a scientist and cast in this role as mismatched wife in this remote place in the world. So even the science is fading a little bit for her. So I'm making decisions like that to accommodate the story first, but also my own limitations. And I don't know, like it finds its rhythm, the novel does. And so too do the subjects find their place in that rhythm.
That's so true. And I think, too, I guess you have the advantage. As you were talking, I was thinking of being able to be in the character's mind, too. She might have known some of it, but there were certainly things she didn't understand. And so you can see it through her eyes, and those eyes aren't going to be all-knowing like any of us. So it's an advantage, right, when you're doing a fictional character.
Yes, for sure. And I mean, that's true of something like science. It's also true of her emotional life. It's also true of the way that she becomes friends with people, of the way that she becomes lovers with people, or anything else that happens in her, the way that she learns to cook, any of these things. The character gets to do a lot of the dictating in terms of their own development. And as a writer, that's, I guess that's another thing that I've learned over the decades of doing this, is that you have to trust them. You have to trust that there are going to be limits, and that they're going to surprise you and do things that you might not do, or that you might not approve of, or anything else. And that's all a part of the process of writing a book.
And that is such a great thing. And that's a great time for us to introduce our listeners to the main characters. Theodolf, am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
Theodolf and Willa. And this is an arranged marriage. And it is, I love this arranged marriage because it's not one of great success, let's say. And it's
quite
very
the contrary, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. It's clear from like the first minutes that, you know, she comes on the ship to in the first boat from in the spring to where Theodolf is with this lighthouse. And she is, I mean, they aren't even interested less necessarily in getting to know one another. It's business. It's you know, they just are trying to make this work for, I think, what are the wrong reasons, right? They're trying to, he wants a wife to, so he has the appearance of being respectable and being able to, you know, proceed in his life as a lighthouse keeper and maybe get higher up. And she is destitute, and she and her mother kind of cook up this scheme so that she gets married. She has to come back from college after her father passes away, and so she like that didn't have a choice. This was going to be her lot in life, and it's just such an interesting relationship. I loved Willa from the very first time she enters the book, and her husband, who is extraordinarily religious. And she questions that from the very beginning and doubts it's almost over the top so much that she feels, wow, this could be performative, right? And he asks her to have a confession before they even have a conversation. And so he has the priest waiting for her when she gets there. I thought that was such a marvelous scene. And she shows us through that confession her spiritedness and, of course, her clever wit, because she made up all of her sins. And she really, I mean, she goes over the top telling this, almost to the point of, I'm sure the priest was just, you know, horrified at what she was saying. Did you have to rein her in the writing?
You know, that's such a great question. And the answer is eventually, yes, you have to rein her in. But one of my practices is that in a scene like that, or any scene of you know, dramatic uptick, let's say, or emotional uptick, I always, or not always, but most often, will elevate the scene to the point of absurdity or to the point of greatest tension or something, in order to know what that upper limit is. And in that scene, in the confessional scene that opens the book, or that is in the opening chapter anyway, I let her go about as far as I thought she could and kept most of it. And I don't usually do that. I usually write to the end, that is the upper tier of what's plausible, and then scale it back for plausibility's sake. But I more or less left that. And I did that because, well, because I think that Willa, as she arrives and as she enters the first day, what is effectively the first day of her marriage, she's already determined to remain herself and to remain true to her aspirations, to remain true to her intellect, to remain true to her cunning. And she's just not going to have it any other way. And I think that part of the reason, and I say all of that now with the benefit of hindsight, but what I recognize is that when I made that decision, I wanted all of that strength of character to be evident at the outset. Because though this is a really difficult situation for her to be in, and for Theodolf to be in too, for that matter, she was going to be the one who was capable of self-reflection, of understanding who she is and how she was changing as a consequence of her new circumstances, and how she was going to make friends and continue to evolve while Theodulf isn't and wasn't. And that point of contrast was an important one for me.
Absolutely, and it comes through, and it makes her a really memorable character. Someone you want to hear her whole story. I mean, she's just wonderful. And then the husband, Theodulf, is the master lighthouse keeper, and he's on this quest for happiness, which is exact opposite of what he is. He is, I think, very unhappy in his life, even though it suits him to be a lighthouse keeper and he does a good job at it. He talks about he's only been happy like a few times in his life, you know, very, very limited times. And one of those times is in Paris in 1900, and he was sent there by his family to figure out his life. And there's just he lives such an isolated life, I think, very, you know, not open to some of these things, except in Paris when he discovers this world. I want to know, did you get to go to Paris and do research so that you could write those sections? And I wonder, too, if maybe there's some lessons for us in his search for happiness, and, you know, how is that search any different than what we're doing in our modern life versus what they might have been pursuing back in the early 1900s?
Well, another great question, Paul. I mean, for Theodulf, I think that one of the things that I wanted to do, that I attempted to do, was set him up as the sort of person who had every advantage in life. He's the son of a Duluth scion, wealthy, intelligent, provided for, like he has every advantage, and yet he can't quite navigate his life or all of that privilege because he can't be true to who he is. And I don't want to spoil it for the folks who haven't read the book yet, but what he carries with him is a deep and abiding shame. As a younger man, he didn't recognize that. I think he's beginning to recognize it as an older man, and certainly Willa recognizes it in him. And so he's stymied because he's been untrue to his own true nature from the time he was a younger man. And so he's working in his psychology and his character are working in ways that Willa's is not. He's stuck replaying an episode from the past while Willa is busy looking up toward the future and even toward the celestial skies, right? So there's quite a point of contrast. But he is also, I hope anyway, a sympathetic character. Maybe for those reasons he's sympathetic. I mean, he's a bore. Let's not confuse the issue. And he's domineering and he's aspires to a patriarchal role that is more and more in question and frankly grotesque by the day. But he's also lived a false life. And this new position, this new marriage, none of that is helping the falsity of any of it. And so he's stuck in a way that Willa would be if she let herself be, but isn't. Those sections were the Paris sections, and I don't know, there must be two or three or four of them. I can't even remember in the book. But they were great fun to write, and I've been to Paris a few times in my life, but I didn't go back to research. But I'll tell you that the researching of the World's Fair in 1900, which is where he goes and what was happening there while he was visiting, were some of the funnest and most interesting things to research in the whole book.
Yeah, I can imagine if you got to go back to that time, it would have been just spectacular because it's a time when everybody was discovering and there was so much festivities and joy and just people from everywhere. I bet it would have been just an incredible time. And those sections are very well drawn and very detailed and very fascinating to think about life at that time. And especially in Theodulf's position, being alone and being ordered to figure out his life. It's just a marvelous piece. And of course, we couldn't not mention one of the other great characters in this book. And I hope I'm going to pronounce her name right. Cilia?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Oh, excellent. Bravo. It's S-I-L-J-E for anyone out there listening, a good Scandinavian name. And she lives with her uncle in the fishing shacks nearby. And she is also a character that just, you know, captured my heart from early on. She lives in poverty and a bit of sadness, but she's a really memorable, quirky character. She carves out of wood, has wolf friends like Fenrir, I think that's how you pronounce it. And she, you know, has a lot of spunk. She predicts shipwrecks and has an intuition that leads her on some adventures. And I just really adored reading about her. How is it that she came into the novel? And I want to highlight for people like the one sentence in the book that just blew my breath away. But I'll let you tell a little bit about Cilia, and then we'll go back to that.
So Cilia, yes, I love Cilia. She's you did a better job of describing her than I would. Oh. To me, she's like the element of magic in the story. And I don't mean magic like she can turn rabbits out of hats. I mean magic like she understands things. She's a 13-year-old girl. She understands things the adults don't. She understands some of the mechanisms at work in the wider world in the way that the adults don't always necessarily understand. And not because she's, not because she's a magician, but because she is so down to earth, I think, of her. In fact, many of her scenes are her in the woods, on the ground, touching the water. So she's very much on earth, whereas Willa is very much in the clouds. And that's a deliberate contrast as well. But she's also funny and mischievous in the way that a lot of kids are. And she provides a kind of possibility in the book that Willa and Theodulf don't. That is the possibility for playfulness, for excitement, for adventure. And she's got the whole world up there as her playground, and she takes advantage of all of it. That she becomes friends with with Willa, and that she does so much to inform her, that is Cilia informing Willa,
yes,
about what is happening, what life offers. These are lessons that Willa has never learned before, because she's been in her sort of ivory tower until now.
And that's, I love that about her, because she has that power to just escape, but also understand her situation, right? And the limits and the realities in a way I think other people try to push aside, or I don't know. There's something about her rootedness that is really admirable. And the sentence that I'm talking about in the book, I don't think it spoils anything. For me, it was a sentence that so perfectly encapsulates when a young girl moves from girlhood to womanhood. And it happens when she goes to a party they're having at the lighthouse, and it's everybody's invited and everybody's there. And she meets Hosea Grimm, who is just oof. he is an old man ogling her, I guess, and talking about his photography and how he wants to take her picture. And, you know, you're kind of just, if, you know, and she gets that intuition. But the thing that happens when she gets back, she connects this to her beloved wolf, or the Fenrir, the wolf that kind of follows her through her life and is a part of the place that they live. And the sentence is, whereas before Fenrir had seemed like an aloof occasional pet, she now saw his teeth as weapons. And I just love that sentence, Peter. There's so much great writing in this book. That's just one example. I think now would be a great opportunity to have you share a passage with us and to give people a little sense of the organization of the book and the some of the ways that the story unfolds.
Yeah, so we've talked about Willa and Theodulf and Cilia. There's a fourth, I guess, what would maybe be called a lesser major character, but Celia's uncle, Mats, mm-hmm. who comes to bear quite large on the story. But there's actually, to my way of thinking, a fifth protagonist in the book, and it is this disembodied voice that speaks at the beginning of each chapter, and indeed is the opening page of the book. And I thought I would read just a brief excerpt from that voice. So this is actually page one of the book. I'll tell you about the moon and the comet and the lighthouse and the light, the storms and the softest hours. I'll tell you about the clockworks and the watchworks, the shipwrecks and survivals. I'll tell you about the wolves and the fawn, the drownings and the orphan. I'll tell you about the sacraments and the sins, and the most beautiful song. I'll tell you about the station master and his wife and the child she fell in love with and the mother she despised and the man who rescued them both. I'll tell you about Kichigami and all her moods. And if you're still of a listening mind, I'll tell you about the dying. But first, I need to report a most peculiar arrival.
Oh. I tell you, those were some of the most fascinating pieces of the novel for me, is those short passages. Every section is introduced with a piece. There's sometimes story hints or puzzles or poems or history lessons, maybe a retelling of events, an introduction of what's coming up. It's such an unusual structure for a novel. And I usually do not go ahead, and I didn't this time, but I was tempted. I was like, who is this voice? I want to know, like, I have guesses, right, of as I'm reading along. And so it was a very compelling, like you said, it is almost another character in the book, this narrator, if you will, of the story. And so I found myself having a lot of fun with that. When did you fall onto this idea about the organization of it?
You know, it's such a peculiar thing, the way novels get put together and get built. And in the case of this, those sections started out as... maybe a good way of describing it is like an organizing principle or something, a way mm-hmm. for me to announce to myself the intentions or the theme of any given chapter that was going to follow, and certainly as a way to keep track of what was happening in the story. But after writing a couple of them, probably, you know, say the first five of them, I realized that something else was going on. And that this voice, this first person voice, who seemed to be all knowing and mm-hmm. seemed to have access to information that even I didn't have access to, seemed to have a knowing that even I didn't have a knowing of, in a way demanded to be considered more and included in the arc of this novel. And so what's a way of saying it? Like, I guess I allowed it, or I encouraged that voice to come along, so much so that it became a kind of companion, like, or a kind of wisdom about the story that I didn't myself possess, but that I could use once I had written it, which all sounds quite flighty and
I get it.
magical or something like that, but it was just true. And so eventually, of course, I came to understand, or at least hopefully anyway, understand what it is doing there and what it is. But I'll certainly never make an announcement about what that is. I think it's very much up to the reader to come to those realizations and discoveries and interpretations on their own.
Yeah, I think I'm the next time I read it, I might just read all the way through with just those and see how that feels. Because it is just, it's a wonderful device. It's a wonderful way to enter this novel and to talk about this story. And I want to remind our listeners, this is Paula Granquist. We're here on Art Zany Radio. I'm talking with novelist Peter Guy, and we're discussing A Lesser Light, the brand new novel on sale now. You can get your copies at your local bookstore. And please come to Content Bookstore on Wednesday, the 23rd of April, 2025, at 7 p.m. And Peter will be reading from this book, so you get to hear more from the novel. And you're also having a conversation with Northfield writer Benjamin Percy, which is, he's one of our favorites. And I bet he'll come up with some zinger questions for you.
Ben's one of my good friends. I'm actually a little nervous about the questions that he might come up with.
Now, sometimes that is a dangerous seat to be in because he can pull some, he knows some stories.
He does indeed.
But I think we're all very much looking forward to that and can't wait. It's so exciting to be able to be a part of you putting this book out into the world. I mean, I'm trying to figure out because, of course, I always have way more questions than we have time for. But maybe I want to bring up the some of the set of characters that became another favorite of mine, and those are the Master Lightkeeper's wives, because two other lightkeepers come. Because obviously, if you're doing a lightkeeper, you have to have on rotation. No one lightkeeper can keep the especially at a place like that where there are such big storms, and Lake Superior has its needs for us to be in connection with it. But these ladies are just they're all learning to be wives, even though one of them has been married 30 years, the other only 3 years. But they kind of are forced to embrace this limits and challenges of this lighthouse life together. And Mrs. Ruth Wilson is just, I adore her too. She's like the wonderful, everyone wants someone like her around, I think, if you're open to her ideas, because she'll share a lot of advice with you.
She's like the counterpoint to Celia's innocence,
Yes.
and her wisdom, the wisdom that she shares with Willa, is more of the earth, I guess, than the kind of magical wisdom that Celia shares with her. And I can remember, I mean, with practically perfect recall, introducing her in the novel. And the way that she commanded my attention and center stage in the scenes that she was in the way of like a woman who knows a lot and who is confident and who is certain of her place in the world. And I was just so grateful for it. I was actually up at the Madeline Island, what's it called? Center of the Arts or whatever the name of it is. Forgive me for not remembering. But I was there doing a residency, the only residency I've ever done in my life, and working like 15 hours a day. And really the whole breadth and scope of her character came to me in a flash, and I wrote about 40 pages of her in over the course of a couple of days. And it
Wow.
was again, a supernatural experience to have her wisdom and her experience pouring onto the page like that, almost like I had no control over what was happening. And I say that, and of course, know that I have all the control. But it's also true that when something like that happens, when a character just starts making demands of the story, when they assert themselves in that way, you have to, as a author, as a novelist, you have to let them run with it. Because those days are way more than offset by the days where you sit staring at a blank page, wondering what's supposed to happen.
Yeah, and she's the one in the story that I think changes the trajectory of the story, because she comes in and Willa is just being just brash and she's not doing her duties very well, and she is, you know, her dislike for her new husband is clear to everybody. And then she, this woman comes in and basically, you know, gives her a reason to do better, and teaches her why it matters that, you know, the house is kept and the food is good, and the, you know, it's okay to give some kindness it actually benefits you. So she's phenomenal. But my favorite advice came from this was page 233, when anyone has the book out there, about a pot of good soup. She says, a pot of good soup can change a whole day, a whole week even. If you change your days and weeks for the better, enough of them, leastways, all of a sudden you've made a good season. If you change enough seasons, well, you get the idea. And then she says, but it's also true that a good pot of soup is better than a bad one, as much as for you as for him. So she's just, that's her personality wrapped up right there. And so she makes the novel just really come to life. So I bet it was a pleasure to, you know, linger with these characters and to, you know, just hang out and let the story unfold. One of the things that I was thinking about for you was, like you mentioned, this is your sixth novel, and of course you gain experience, but each novel kind of has its own rules and things you have to figure out, and its own, you know, revelations and character development. But I was also pondering the fact, many of our listeners may know that, because we've talked before, that you have been a part of the Loft novel writing project, year-long novel writing project, and it's 8 years you've been doing that, which I think is really interesting as a writer. You come in contact, I think there's about a dozen students each time, with all these novels that are in process. And I wonder if you can reflect on, you know, being a teacher, and how, if that's been able to help you in your own writing, or how you've, you know, learned over the years about the creation of a novel.
You know, I think that those years of teaching, above anything, first of all, it's important to say that they were joyful. You know, I mean, I love it. I love the conversation and the camaraderie of groups like that. It's like having a book club and a writing group all in one, and you spend time talking about the work, yes, but also this larger thing called fiction, you know, that I need to learn about constantly. And so it's this wonderful, it's been a wonderful experience. And what it has taught me, I think, above anything else, is the necessity of order in what can often feel like, and what the writer often wants to make into a ethereal, metaphysical practice. You know, you're going to sit down and the muse is going to strike you, and all of a sudden, the words will pour out of you. And that does sometimes happen. It happened with Ruth Wilson in my case. But more often than not, it takes planning. It takes diligence. It takes organization. It takes commitment. And each of those ingredients is 1,000 times more important than having access to the muse. And it's, I think over the years, what that show, I mean, that's what the experience of teaching all those years showed me, is that you need to have that organization. And now, I mean, I think about how I am writing the book that I'm working on now versus how I wrote the first book that I wrote. And it's unrecognizable, one process versus the other. This one is so organized and so well planned, versus basically just sitting around sometimes for months at a time waiting for that lightning bolt that sometimes did and more often did not come. And that sounds maybe a little bit, when I say it out loud, like, oh, the joy must be lost or something like that. On the contrary, the reward of hard work has always, I mean, I'm a Minnesotan after all, it's always been its own thing. But there's art in it. I mean, absolutely, positively art. And it's like the difference between, I don't know, like architecture in the case of being well planned, and choir or something like that, you know, where you're just singing and hoping to hit the right notes and that sort of thing. And so that's, I mean, that's what the years of teaching that class taught me.
Yeah, I think that's an incredible experience, not something that not everyone gets. And so as we wrap up, I think I want to talk just a little bit about that idea that the book wrestles with, and that is this sort of the exploration of fates and futures. You know, what is it that we actually control, and how do we shape our lives? How conscious were you of this theme as you were writing the story? And did writing the story change any of your ideas about these, ways of existing in the world, or, living our lives as we hope, or just hoping that it unfolds in the way that we want, or making it unfold the way that we want?
Oh man, I mean that's an intense question.
Yes, it took a long novel to, explore some of it, but you must have
Well, and
thought
I'm
about
thinking,
it more than most of us.
well, and I, that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, if you spend all day thinking about it for 5 years on end, you're going to, on the one hand, you're going to have trouble discerning reality from fiction because that happens no matter what when you're writing a novel. But you're also going to have real life in the hours that you're not writing, standing in and making a mockery of the high ideas that you have when you are writing.
Oh,
And
fascinating.
I think, I mean, that's, I guess that's putting it quite strongly, but the idea that in, you know, again, in the one hand, you have to hold the work and the mystery and magic and hard work of it all. And on the other hand, you have to mow the lawn and go to the grocery store and do the laundry and make sure your kids are happy and going to school and learning and preparing them for their future and preparing for your own future and all these things. And it's pretty much an impossible task to do all of that, as any parent knows, and still feel like you're in control. And yet I need to be in control when I'm writing the novel. So it's almost like these two forces are at odds with each other, while the work is going on and while you're thinking about it consciously. But I'll tell you this also, that when I stand back, and I don't mean to sound grandiose about this at all, this is just my own experience and my own reflection on the work that I've done. When I stand back and look at this book or look at the other books that I've written and think about what they taught me and how those lessons reverberate in my life, I mean, they've done more than anything to teach me about how to be alive. And not because I'm great, some great philosopher or seer or spiritual advisor or anything like that, but because all of that hard work has to mean something, and it does mean something to me. And I think that it's the reflection upon them more than in it at the time, when I'm in it at the time, where those rewards start to make sense. And more than anything, I'm hopeful that for all readers, yes, but especially for those readers that I'm closest to, which is to say, my own children, my brother and sisters, my wife, my best friends, that these novels are entertainments and that they are fascinating in their own way, but that they're also a reflection of me, and that for all the ways that I can't show myself to the people that I love, maybe these books can do some of the work of that. And that's what I'm really hopeful for. If there's such a thing as caring about how the books exist in the world, that's the main consideration for me.
I think that is so perfect. I'm furiously taking notes here as you're talking, and I don't think I've heard anyone talk about it in that way, and that it makes sense. And it's phenomenal how you found that you know, that yin and yang, if you will, of those worlds. And this is such a beautiful book, and I'm so excited for it to be out in the world and for our listeners to be able to know that they can go pick up their copy now or join us at Content on Wednesday and have even deeper discussions about what's happening in this book. It's just an incredible, incredible achievement. So congratulations, and I'm so excited that we had this time to be together to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was just great catching up with you, and thank you for your enthusiasm and for your thoughtful questions. I love getting to think about it like this. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
We will see you. Thank you, my guest Peter Guy, today on Art Zany Radio. I appreciate you. We'll see you on Wednesday. Folks, this is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. I want to thank you so much for joining us as we celebrate all things creating. And of course, I want you to always remember to add a little bit of your imagination to every day of your life. And of course, always add some Art Zany as well.